had posted a thread about the economic latest update on Lebanon. And Samson Mao just commented on that thread saying, we are all Lebanese. You are all Lebanese. You just don't know it yet. So yeah, this is, in summary, is like we all live in this fiat Keynesian world where central banks are all designed the same way. It's only a matter of time for you to realize, are you going to stay in the system? Your time, effort, and energy is being really eaten away from you, your kids, your grandchildren, or you're going to wake up and really to start saving your time in a really the only secure property ever invented.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Today we are here with Suli Kobayashi, a gentleman like many of the guests on this podcast who wears many hats, Bitcoin educator, investor, consultant, originally from Lebanon, travels quite frequently. I actually met Suli in Ghana at a restaurant in Ghana. We had a great conversation, and upon having that conversation, we wanted to continue it. So here we are today to continue that conversation. But before we dive in, let me hand the mic over to you, Suli, to give so you can give a bit of a broader overview of who you are and what it is you do.
Thanks, Frank. I'm happy that we're resuming the conversation. It was a hell of a night back then. I'm a pleb, a Lebanese pleb, born and raised in Lebanon, moved from Lebanon almost a decade ago. I've been traveling to Lebanon and the region every 6 weeks for 3 weeks. Fast forward, what I do today is I help Bitcoin companies operate in the region, like in the Middle East and Africa, and I onboard fiat companies on Bitcoin. In short, this is pretty much it. I'm involved in like with other plebs in Lebanon and in the region to educate about Bitcoin and try to build on Bitcoin. Yeah, that's it.
Very cool. Very cool. So let's actually start with the macro overview. And for everyone who's listening, we have some people who are new to Bitcoin who listen to this podcast. The term he's using, pleb, just kind of means the average person who's into Bitcoin, the average Joe or Jane who's just kind of working to make Bitcoin better and more accessible to people and just kind of, yeah, the everyday person. So let's zoom out. I've read a lot about Lebanon. You know, it usually gets put in this basket of countries like Turkey, Venezuela, Lebanon, Argentina, of, you know, in some ways, and I don't mean this to be too harsh, in some ways, a failed state. Like things have really sort of, you know, experiencing serious amounts of inflation, people really struggling. But I'm always sort of interested to hear not only what the situation is like, but also how people are coping and getting by. I've mentioned this to you off camera before, but, you know, I lived in Venezuela and, you know, there's pretty wild stuff you hear on the news. And the story that you hear on the ground is sometimes in some ways it's similar, in some ways it's quite different. So I guess I'm sort of asking you, what does it look like on the ground and what are people doing to get by right now?
Thanks, Frank, for bringing attention to the critical issue. I've witnessed firsthand the unfolding of Lebanon's crisis. Obviously, I had a bank account in Lebanon, just like the rest of the Lebanese, even after moving from Lebanon. The issue is, whatever happened in Lebanon has been happening all over the world, like you mentioned. We think, oh, those guys are poor in Lebanon, like what's happening? It's the banking system in Lebanon, or those are the political parties in Lebanon, but the whole system is designed the same way. So what happened in Lebanon is like since October 2019, the country has been spiraling into one of the most severe economic crises in modern history, basically. I think it's Macron, the French president, who called it the worst Ponzi scheme ever happened on humans, in the history of humanity. Imagine a once flourishing society called like the Geneva of the Middle East, Paris of the Middle East, now grappling with a currency that's lost more than 95% of its value. Inflation's soaring into triple digits. Now the central bank has been trying to suppress the liquidity in a way to maintain some stability in the exchange rate, at the, especially with what's happening in the black market. It's a scenario where the basic necessities are becoming luxuries overnight for most of the Lebanese. This crisis didn't appear out of nowhere. I mean, if you people tend to talk about Lebanon, what's been happening after 2019, but from 2019 back in time, from 1992 up until 2019, there was a peg to the dollar of the Lebanese currency. But even before the 1990s, the Lebanese lira or the Lebanese pound have been really depreciating and losing its value. So inflation has started the moment we broke the gold standard. So now there are political deadlocks. There is corruption at the government. The situation has been aggravated after the COVID hit, especially like COVID hit within the framework of the same economic turmoil. So things have been really not functioning in the country. There was the Beirut port explosion in August 2020. That was catastrophic. It was like the you know, when you're watching a boxing game, then you have the KO that put the other guy to the floor. So after the explosion, it was really like a massive traumatic impact on the whole population. Political instability, and it's the same in Africa or Latin America with the countries you've mentioned. Economic mismanagement can erode the fabric of society. Lebanon's situation echoes these patterns, especially like with the since 2011 and the war in Syria. There has been an influx of Syrian refugees from Syria to Lebanon because we're at the borders. We have Palestine from one border and Syria from the other border. So we're the really great position. So the human impact has been really heart-wrenching. People are struggling to afford food, the business necessity, the basic necessities. Even the business owners are really struggling to get electricity. Like, you need to get your own generator to make sure that you have diesel, because diesel also gets stopped sometimes. Even now, the Starlink is not functioning in Lebanon because the government has put some restrictions on satellite connectivity, because only the army and the American embassy in Lebanon and the American university in Lebanon are allowed to have satellite connections. And Mr. Musk is with freedom. So, to be fair, maybe it's not on Musk, it's on the Lebanese government. So there are a lot to the Lebanese economic issue. There has been some effort to address these challenges locally through movements. Yet because of the country has been led, unfortunately, by the warlords who fought from 1975 up until 1990. In 1990, like my mom says, they removed their costume, military costume, and they put their tuxedos on, and they're still at sea until today. So you can imagine how things are. Now, what they're trying to do is a bailout from the IMF, $2 billion or $3 billion bailout. And to be fair, if you do the numbers, Lebanon on a normal year needs $2 billion just to survive. So I don't really know what's going to happen with $2 or $3 billion, knowing that there has been billions of dollars loaned to Lebanon for decades and corruption had eaten them all. Like, we have bridges that have been that are under construction for the last 30 years in Lebanon. but there are some goodwill. There are some independent activists and movements who are trying to put some reforms in place. Let's hope for the best. But in my personal opinion, it doesn't look great. It looks great from a Bitcoin perspective, because I strongly believe like people learn through pain, unfortunately, not through intellectual curiosity. Lebanon is a typical Bitcoin story, right? But unfortunately, the people in Lebanon don't want to realize it's a money problem. Yeah. Just like the other developed countries keep snoozing on the matter. So on the second part of the question is like, how are people getting by? They're barely surviving, really. Today, the normal Lebanese So you have two type of Lebanese. So people working at the Lebanese government, and the Lebanese government, like the governments are not functioning. The public servants are not going to work. They're now going once or twice a week to the ministry. So if you're selling a land or buying a house or you have any official statement you need to do, forget it, man. You need to pay under the table for someone to, or like to encourage an employee to come to his office to pay his transport for him to come do your paper. And the people working in the private in the private sector are really finding it difficult to survive because businesses today, Lebanon is a net importer, so you have companies that are getting foreign currency from outside. Those companies are able to at least pay their Lebanese employees partially in dollars. But you have millions who are like getting paid in Lebanese pounds, man. And this is really catastrophic. It's down to the business owner who's really feeling like that he needs or she can increase the salaries or not. But it's not sustainable. No one can really plan ahead. And then you have the business owners. The business owners are like a category by themselves, where like you have a lot of bankruptcies, people like selling their business because they can't survive. This is how people are getting by, unfortunately.
It's mind-boggling. And I just want to rewind a little bit back to what you said about pain being a teacher for people. I think it is for some. I think it almost it's like pain, plus people who are sort of willing to look for maybe a solution that in the past they might not have looked to, something like Bitcoin or stable coins maybe. But the It doesn't always happen that way. People tend to sort of complain, want the government to fix it, want sort of they don't want to come to grips with the fact that the old system is failing. It's probably not going to get better, and that there is a new system that can help them. But you do have to put in some work to sort of start to understand this new system, to not think it's a scam, to understand how to custody Bitcoin, things, So it's a very difficult process to sort of open people's eyes to something. And also, I don't know what the volatility of Bitcoin looks like versus the Lebanese pound. But I would also imagine that some people, if they are thinking about holding a different currency, it's dollars. That seems to be the case in a lot of places, though many in the Bitcoin community would say, like, well, if they only turn to Bitcoin, it's like, yeah, it's easier to say that when you're not in the situation. I think people tend to revert to what they feel is the most safe thing, even if maybe cognitively or intellectually there might be something that's a bit safer for them. So what does Bitcoin adoption look like on the ground? Do you see more people trying to flee to dollars, or do people not even have that privilege? Do they not even have any sort of disposable or discretionary income to use to try to offset what they're experiencing in the native currency?
Frank, that's a very pertinent question. Like everyone I talk to just like ask the same question because it's just obvious for us, especially in these times of economic uncertainties. But from what's happening, really from my experience, it's not accurate to say that most Lebanese people view Bitcoin as a definitive solutions. But there's definitely a growing interest in it, particularly among those keen on exploring alternative financial systems to escape from the Lebanese banks, because they lost the trust in the banks, definitely. But to start saving from zero, like they're still getting some income or trying to create new jobs or selling their services or products for something, they want to store it in something. Many have went to gold, just like many other countries in Africa and the Middle East that went through the same. People go start investing in collectibles at first. And then it's too expensive to go to buy watches, and then they start with the coins of gold, etc. And then, yeah, they shift. They start hearing about what's happening in the Bitcoin space. Like in my travels, I've noticed like this is the same pattern. Like if you want to call it Bitcoin, as well as the shit coins, including stable coins, as
Whatever.
you mentioned. It often enters the conversation. Like we have a couple of platforms on Telegram mainly, and there's a P2P marketplace. I remember 2 years ago, someone just sold his car, like announced that he wanted to sell his car for for a stable coin, not one, but like in stable coin or in Bitcoin. Others now are like publishing that they want to sell their property for crypto. So people are thinking of these alternatives. Like in Lebanon, amidst the turmoil, we keep witnessing these trends happening, but until when it will be supported or like under the eye of the government without anything happening? Because in 2013, the Central Bank of Lebanon, and that's 6 years before the crisis, the Central Bank governor, the same governor who really designed the whole Ponzi, he warned all the commercial banks not to support Bitcoin / crypto investments or trading. Some commercial banks did close some accounts, and that was the drive for me back in the day why to really empty my bank account buying Bitcoin. Just this is how I escaped from the whole crisis, because for me it didn't make sense. The Central Bank of Lebanon, who's the main owner and investor of the only casino in Lebanon, the Casino du Liban, who was really preventing people from investing where they want, which was ridiculous for me. That motivated me to really to get into Bitcoin through my Lebanese bank account. Was my key entrance to Bitcoin. Sorry.
And when was this? And also, was it fairly easy to move money from a bank account to an exchange at that point?
Yes, we're talking 2017. That was before the crisis. Even though I got warned by a friend of mine who worked at the same bank where I used to operate, and he told me just be careful because like we did close bank accounts. And back then I was a shitcoiner trader, by the way. So, but yeah. That happened just before the crisis. But yeah, it was fairly straightforward. Back then, I had no clue about what self-custody was, etc. But yeah, moving from money from Lebanon to the exchanges was completely normal and easy. Today, you still can do that, but you need to open a specific account at the bank, which is much more expensive, obviously. And it's not like at the reach to any normal Joe who can do it, unfortunately. So yeah, this is why P2P comes to place, and we have a very big peer-to-peer platform which is now operating, I think, on Telegram. This is where I mentioned to you like someone like sold or they wanted to sell their car and properties with crypto, and this is where there's a format. If you look it up online, you can enter, and there are different groups. Basically, you just announce you want to sell or to buy. You mention the amount and the area you're in. Obviously, it's up to you to do the due diligence to know who you're dealing with. But there are brokers who've been really opening like mushrooms in different areas. And to be fair, if you like most of the brokers, like they got the level of standards really high. It's like a 5-star service. Where everyone is like competing to the same standard, where there's this etiquette, you can call a broker, they would send someone to your doorstep. They would send you the Bitcoin first, and then you pay them in cash. That's mind blowing. But to be fair, I don't know how long would that last, because there are some, the government is trying today through the broker to KYC everyone. By keeping track, so it's no longer really no KYC. I mean, I don't know how it is, but it's still a peer-to-peer. Until when will they still keep an eye on it? I think today the government and the central bank and the Ministry of Finance are busy dealing with the chaos and to get the bailout, etc. But once they do, otherwise it's gonna things will continue and the snowball is gonna get bigger and bigger. I don't think it's going to last longer to be accessing Bitcoin that easy in Lebanon, just like everywhere else. This is in my own opinion. So in summary, Bitcoin is not a panacea in Lebanon by most in Lebanon, let me say. But it's certainly growing of interest and particularly potentially a hedge against the banks and the trust and the fiat system. It's a small yet significant step towards the financial autonomy to the Lebanese, who learned to be resilient over time, because this is not the first crisis that Lebanon goes through. Like Lebanon got through 15 years of civil war from 1975 to 1990, as I told you, and it wasn't easy. So, and ever since, there hasn't been really a government that's offering social security or hospitalization or education to the people. So, the every Lebanese, at least born and raised there, is taught to think of plan B, C, D, E, F from being in school. Like today, the schools are like the education, like poverty levels are really skyrocketing. You have, I think, 70% at least that are under poverty level. The country is living off the remittances and the Lebanese diaspora outside Lebanon. You have more Lebanese outside Lebanon than Lebanon, by the way. And this started, and this started in the 70s mainly because of the civil war. There has been this drain of talent and brains from Lebanon. You have a lot of entrepreneurs who went to Africa for trading, then to Australia, and then to Latin America. This is where you have millions, dozens of millions outside Lebanon, and you have only 4 million Lebanese, and now you have an additional at least million and a half Syrian and half a million Palestinian. There's a lot happening, and down the line, demographically, things don't look so positive, let me say, unfortunately.
Are people not having children? Is that what you're getting at?
No, actually, they're having a lot of children.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Demographically, in the sense where I was working with the United Nations a decade ago and before, there was a study that was made just in 2011 when the Syrian crisis started that said 25% of the Lebanese population would be from Syrian origin in 10 years.
Wow.
That's more than 10 years ago. Today, even on the news, you have villages in Lebanon where you have more Syrians than Lebanese. There are a lot of confusing, worrying things happening, really, because like until when would now today the host community is really hosting Syrians with no problem, etc. But the Lebanese are struggling to live. The Lebanese are struggling to find jobs. The Syrians, on the other hand, are able to compete for jobs because the inflation on the Syrian currency started earlier in 2011, 2013. Oh. So the Syrian can get less salary in Lebanon and live off it compared to the Lebanese. So there's this competition to find jobs. Now, to be fair, unfortunately, there are cultural reasons that would help in those areas, because like the Lebanese are like they like to work in specific sectors. They're very, most of them are lazy, not working agriculture or labor, where Syrians are excellent at that. And this is where, but there isn't like enough to get equilibrium in place. And one interesting fact, like, because the Lebanon has been hosting Palestinian refugees for decades. And the Lebanese constitution has mentioned that a Palestinian, and that's before the latest issues happening and the war on Palestine, a Palestinian is only allowed to work as a concierge in a building or agriculture. Or labor work. So if you're a Lebanese company, you can't employ a Palestinian to have fully like to benefit from social security, even though the social security doesn't really offer much. But you know what I'm saying? I see the same thing happening today for the Syrians because they've put that law in place to protect the Lebanese unemployment from the Palestinian talent in the country. But now that the Syrian talent is increasing, I'm afraid that maybe they're going to be inspired from the history and do the same. If that happens, it's going to create a lot of problems, really. And if that doesn't happen, God knows what will happen, because like we're operating without a president for a long time now. I forgot, like it's been like almost a year. We have a parliament who's been ruled by the same people for the past 30. I mean, sorry if I keep talking about this, but like when we were in school in math, there is this I'm French educated, but I don't know how it's called in English. In algebra, you have this symbol, which is a null. It's a zero, which is a bared in the middle,
With the
and
slash through it,
with a slash through it. And back in the day, teachers used to tell us like, "This is that means there is no solution." I never got that before the Lebanese situation. We're like, maybe there is no solution, but maybe with Bitcoin there is a solution, but no one is gonna. I mean, let's see how they will get their mind around it. One thing that I keep talking about in Lebanon and in the region, because the Middle East is very hot due to what's happening, the resources and the conflict of powers, etc. And if you open the world map, Lebanon is at the center of it. And for Lebanon to adopt Bitcoin, geopolitically, the surrounding countries will have to adopt Bitcoin. But unfortunately, from my opinion, I don't think any of the neighboring countries will adopt Bitcoin for geopolitical reasons, because we do know how strong Bitcoin is and how censorship resistant it is, and how decentralized it is. So that solution to the problem, Bitcoin in specific, I don't want to be negative or anything. It's my country I'm talking about, but it's going to take a long time.
And I appreciate the honesty, to be honest, because I that's what I'm the more conversations I have with people, the more this tends to be what I'm learning. You know, it's just not an easy process for this to happen, though it could be helpful. But you just talked about those geopolitical concerns, whether or not adoption in the neighboring regions is going to happen. All of these things are just tremendous, tremendous factors that often don't get discussed in nuance when everyone's yelling at each other on Twitter. So
Yes.
it's something we truly do need to consider. And I try to look at things. I didn't know you worked for the UN. I did some work for them as well, and I try to look at things. In a lot of the countries I've traveled to and lived in, I was actually in almost all of them aside from El Salvador. And when I went back to Ghana, where I met you, I didn't even know what Bitcoin was during these times. So when I was in these countries, either teaching or doing development work or whatever I was doing, I was constantly just sort of looking at what potential solutions were and then how challenging it would be to enact, to bring those solutions to life. And there are just a billion factors that do not often get touched upon, some of them cultural, some of them political. And, it's a challenge, and you hope that it isn't super extreme pain that brings people to something like Bitcoin, because I don't think anybody wants to see a world that looks like that. People might joke about it or whatever, how hyper Bitcoinization is going to happen. I personally, I don't know, I'm a sensitive person. I don't want to see that much suffering in the world, to be honest. So I hope that it happens sort of more slowly and more steadily than because people are experiencing just an ungodly amount of pain. I think as you're talking, I think I remember either you posting this or someone else posting it, but I think it says, I think the tweet or the meme was something like, in a certain amount of time or on different time frames, we're all Lebanon or we're all Lebanese. And because of the fiat system, the US is in a debt spiral. It is not going to be able to meet its financial obligations, for Social Security and the other things that financially support the social safety net. It can't happen mathematically. The biggest line item on the US budget right now is the interest on our debt. That's saying a lot for a country who's well known for its military industrial complex and the amount of money we spend to maintain that. So, was it you that posted that? And could you expand a little bit on what that means? On a certain time frame, we're all Lebanese. We're all going to experience something to this degree.
Yeah, thanks. I forgot about that. So basically, I had posted a thread about the economic latest updates on Lebanon, and Samson Mao just commented on that thread saying, "We are all Lebanese. You are all Lebanese. You
That's
just
what it
don't know
was.
it yet."
Yeah, right.
So yeah, this is in summary, it's like we all live in this fiat Keynesian world where central banks are all designed the same way. It's only a matter of time for you to realize, are you going to stay in the system? Your time, effort, and energy is being really eaten away from you, your kids, your grandchildren, or you're gonna wake up and really to start saving your time in a really the only secure property ever invented. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was Samson Mao who commented, but I do agree. Yeah, I think I remember people thinking I was sort of crazy when I would write these newsletters explaining like, look, money in a bank isn't really your money. It's an IOU. It's an unsecured loan or partially unsecured loan to an institution. And everything else you look at, your 401k, all this kind of stuff, it can be deleted with a keystroke. There's only three things that are actually money and or currency. You have dollars in your hand, maybe precious metals, something along those lines, and Bitcoin and cold storage outside or off of an exchange. And I think I've gotten quite accustomed to people thinking I'm insane, but it's like, you know, now I think people are starting to be like, oh, wait a second. And you have people from Franklin Templeton and Larry Fink talking about how Bitcoin is censorship resistant coming on. And you're like, is this where the narrative is? These are the people who are going to start telling this side of the narrative. And I have my reservations about the ETF. It's a story for another day, but it is interesting to see this becoming part of the mainstream media narrative. I say interesting because, again, I don't get too excited about this stuff because it's indicative of something bad that's looming. You know, if we're talking about this sort of stuff, it means that society's not in a good place. We're not really trusting each other. We don't trust our old institutions. And just, I mean, I spent 12 years as a teacher getting people to change, getting people to do stuff that's uncomfortable for them. It's not an easy process. So it's usually not a pretty process. It's a bit of an ugly process. But I think it is important to have these conversations. And if these conversations resonate with people, what I always tell people is like, yeah, it might be uncomfortable, but maybe just try to lean into some of that discomfort and see what you can do to maybe understand this better or to do something maybe technically, whether it's putting Bitcoin in cold storage that you didn't think you could do because you're not a technically minded person. I think it's time to wear hats that you in the past might not have been comfortable wearing and to get comfortable wearing those, because I think we're moving into a future where it will be helpful if you can do so. All right, cool. So we talked a lot about the challenges and everything here. So you're an investor. What gets you excited? You know, what are you excited to invest in? I mean, Bitcoin is a very cool technology in and of itself, but we also need technology to make that technology accessible to people. So when you think about investing in Bitcoin companies or well, actually, we'll get to education in a second. What gets you excited right now? What are you looking at that you're hopeful about?
I'm just hoping to have more Bitcoin companies. That's one, because there aren't many. And each company has its own priorities. For me, it's like, I'd like to see the companies that are working for Lebanon and the region. Yep. Because like when Bitcoin is stopped for any reason in the West, nothing changes for the Westerners. But if Bitcoin is stopped in the global South or Lebanon or Africa, things change.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is currently, and this is why I am very extremely bullish on Bitcoin. And we've been in Ghana together. You see the amount of development happening in Africa is mind blowing. And the future is only going to accelerate this. And I try to support the initiatives that are supporting the region. But I know that there are a lot of great potential companies that would cover Africa and the world, but baby steps, one at a time.
I love that you're supporting companies there that are supporting the region. I was with someone from BTrust on Thursday, someone who went through that program, which is a program in Africa, based in Africa, that helps to educate software developers to work on Bitcoin and Lightning. One of the points that she made, which I thought was excellent, was, you know, we don't need more Western companies creating solutions that work in the West and then trying to export those things to the global South, Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia. What we need is people on the ground who understand the nature of the problems, creating technology that's going to work to help solve those problems. So you're nodding along. Do you see a lot of that happening?
100%.
Cool.
100%. Nice. I think the best to put it in a really maxi toxic way is Femi Lange. I think you heard Femi.
He's great.
It's exactly it how this lady mentioned it on your podcast. Because there's like the copy paste can work, But it's not really sustainable. No one knows Africa more than the Africans. No one knows the Middle Easterns more than the Middle Eastern. I mean, of course, there are goodwill and Western companies wanting to work, but the success, and there's part of my fiat mining is in supply chain, and Nestle has a success story where within like hundreds and thousands of their factories, they were able to drop their costs by, let's say, 10 or 15%, because on one operator, on one line, he was putting a screw under one of the lines during the production lines. And that line was more efficient than any other factory in the world of Nestle. So they sent like investigators from Switzerland, et cetera, to know really what really was different. The people were the same, the processes were the same, the machines the same, the raw materials the same. It was down to the operator on the line who identified that if there was a screw that is hiring that line that bit, things will get faster by a few seconds. So just giving the example here, like as much as people would try to make things for the region, it's only on us to build something that we need. And believe it that if we will hopefully will create something for Africa, it will be usable by the West. And the future for the West, I mean, in my opinion, I'm based in the West, is not as light. It's much more darker, unfortunately. I think the light is more on Africa and the Middle East rather than the West. With all the control, all the taxation happening, etc., people are going to flee from the West, go to Africa, where you'll have more freedom. And hopefully things by then will get much better.
Yeah, I think it's something that I could feel inside of me, especially as someone who's moved around a lot. I could feel it and it really saddens me. In some ways, I really love New York, but especially in New York State with the bit license and so much of the nonsense that's gone around. Like, there's no exchanges that are even legally allowed to support Lightning in New York because of the bit license and money transmitter laws. It's really, really sad to think that somewhere that was once the financial capital of the world is truly not anymore. I've written a lot about this, and I'm going to start getting involved to some level, educating legislators here, but I'm not quite hopeful about that, to be honest. I'm imagining that even if I do present a legitimate argument, whatever money is supporting these people that comes from the old financial guard is going to have much more of an influence than any sort of rational, you know, cognitive take that I can offer to these people. And it's a sad thing because from a cultural angle, I taught immigrants here for many, many years. You know, I think it has been my family. You know, I come from immigrants like everyone else in New York. It's a beautiful culture. It really is a place where sort of anyone can become a New Yorker pretty quickly. But given what I'm watching around the world, I wrote a piece on it for Bitcoin Magazine, and some people thought I was being facetious, but I truly don't. I don't feel hope when I look at what's happening in New York, and I do feel hope when I speak with people, particularly from Africa, to some level Latin America as well. But Africa really seems to be leading the charge in terms of the energy that the developers are putting into this and their optimism about this. And I think, I felt it while I was there in person at the African Bitcoin Conference this year. So yeah, I'm super bullish on Africa. The more I speak with people from there, the more bullish I get. Part of me is a little bit sad that I feel like I'll have to leave to go there one day just to sort of have the certain freedoms that I'm seeing people starting to embrace. Not only people, but governments. Governments there, the members of governments, what I'm seeing is that they're far more open-minded. They see they're willing to sort of hear people out, whereas here it's just politicians are paid off. They're going to keep the old financial guard in business, and you know, it is what it is. On that note, on the old financial guard note, what are your thoughts about the ETF? About so much Bitcoin now being concentrated in the hands of the people that, on some level, Bitcoin was like supposed to represent. You know, supposed to be a new financial platform system. What do you think?
I was playing around with AI gadgets the other day. I made a small robotic slideshow about the ETFs and versus Bitcoin. So ETFs is just like paper Bitcoin. It's not real Bitcoin for anyone listening who doesn't know. So ETFs will help Bitcoin being more legit for banks, more
Yeah.
legit for governments. That would help Bitcoin, definitely. That would bring more volatility because more traders trade ETFs. So more liquidity. If we've been thinking of like the volatility of Bitcoin is, in my opinion, is going to be reduced. It's not. The volatility on Bitcoin will be reduced by proper adoption of Bitcoin and people understanding what Bitcoin is. Of course, in Africa, Bitcoin and in the Middle East tend to be not a store of value, but a medium of exchange. And this is what it's meant to be. Of course, it needs to be a store of value to store your time and effort, etc. But being the only medium of exchange that is reliable can be, regardless of, I'm not talking about the fees, I'm talking layer one, layer twos, and layer threes in the future. What I think of ETFs, I hate them. Of course, I hate them on a personal level. I strongly believe it only give more importance to Bitcoin. But the interesting part is what Gensler announced on the day of the announcement. Like, yeah, what? Just FYI, we're not with Bitcoin. We don't support Bitcoin. Like, you were teaching Bitcoin in MIT or God knows what university
That's
was,
right.
and
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous, really. Like, anyone, like, we tend to, I mean, I don't think he's not my hero, but it's very easy to look at like Gensler or anyone who comes from who knows what they're talking about, at least. But the moment anyone starts working for a Keynesian fiat government, they're just following orders. Don't think that they're going to change the system. They're not going to change the system for you. So the ETFs are good for Bitcoin, in the sense of people to know about Bitcoin. Yeah. I mean, like now you have, like you mentioned, the Larry Fink's talking about censorship resistance. Like, those are salespeople who would sell. They need marketing content, and Bitcoin is so strong; it has so many, and they're gonna follow the hype and see what's the trend. Is it like people are like trying to follow freedom, so they're gonna sell them the freedom arguments? If people are in it for the tech, they're gonna talk about tech and what's being built on Bitcoin. If they're gonna talk about security, they're gonna talk about security and how secure Bitcoin is. If they're gonna talk about energy and how like green energy Bitcoin is using and how it's helping the economies around the mining, what's happening in Africa, for example, or in other places, they're gonna pitch every single
That's
argument.
true.
So they're yeah, and it makes them look good for the brainwashed mainstream media followers. So.
Because it'll seem sort of just edgy enough. It'll seem like just sort of like, oh, this thing is kind of cool. Maybe I'll buy some of this instead of some gold because now it's sort of kind of new, but it's also accepted. And it's weird. I also felt there was a small part of me that was like, do I even want to write about this anymore now that it's become a sort of mainstream asset on this level? And I think it didn't take long for me to come to the conclusion that, of course, I do, because what's going to be talked about in the mainstream media, there's going to be a lot of nonsense, as you said, a lot of marketing around this, trying to get people to buy that product. Whereas the position I'm going to continue to take is buy real Bitcoin, learn how to use it, understand the technology, understand why it's important. Arthur Hayes recently spoke about this, and he said, like, look, do you want price exposure to it to have more dirty fiat, or do you want to actually save your money in Bitcoin itself? And I think that that's the big distinction that needs to be made. Whether or not people will really care one way or another remains to be determined. I do just feel sort of sick when I see the amount of Bitcoin that BlackRock is holding. But you know, whatever, Bitcoin is for everyone. Everyone can do whatever they want with it. It is what it is. I just hope we don't see, I don't know. I don't hope they get the sort of power they might need to, you know, start proposing increased block sizes and to get people on their sides to see a new sort of block size war. I hope they don't. I truly hope. I've been told that I'm wrong in saying, you know, like, God, it's, you know, you're
I
just
mean,
thinking crazy.
to change, yeah. I think it's not crazy to think about it because history showed us that it might happen and it did happen. And from it, you have 26,000 shitcoins that forked from Bitcoin.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it might happen, and that would create a better Bitcoin. Good for them. Let them do it. And they want to make money out of it. We're in a free market. Let's do it. But to change Bitcoin and Bitcoin to go to zero and like to change things, you need the Bitcoin core developers to stop believing in Bitcoin.
Right.
You need the miners to stop believing in Bitcoin. You need the plebs to really, and the really the diamond hands to let go of their Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And you have traders who are professional traders who believe in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you need these four to come together and really for Bitcoin to die. And at least I know, you have many of us who are willing to die on this hill and even
oh, no
lose
question.
Our Bitcoin tomorrow.
Totally.
We've tried for a cause, for a proper cause. But like just to get back to the ETFs, I think Bitcoin can, to get Bitcoin, you can either buy it, earn it, or mine it and have it on your signing device or hardware wallet. Any other way, it's not your Bitcoin, it's not a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the future will tell how things will go. But at the same time, other companies would be now encouraged to get more Bitcoin exposure.
Yep.
Let's see, outside the US as well. And yep. For decentralization, the miners around the world and the different mining pools that are starting will definitely be helping with the decentralization as well.
Yeah, I'm excited about the I'm hoping mining itself becomes more decentralized as well. I think that will be really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to finish up with one important question. You've recently posted, I wouldn't say it's a meme, I guess an illustration on Twitter about Bitcoin being Ikigai. And I've heard many people say this, OB from Fedimint and a lot of bigger names in the space. I personally feel this as well. So Ikigai is a Japanese term that it's sort of the culmination of many different dimensions of life in one thing. Maybe you could actually describe it better, but that's how I would say it. I lived in Japan for a little bit and I've heard people use the term. So it's like your purpose plus the way that you make money plus the thing that brings you joy and all of this sort of wrapped into one thing. And I think most people who don't really have a deep understanding of Bitcoin would think, oh, you're just being hyperbolic, you're ridiculous, you're a crazy person. So I wanted to hear you, if you don't mind, expand a little bit on that. Why do you consider Bitcoin your Ikigai? What dimensions of your life, I probably should ask this backwards, I should say, what dimensions of your life doesn't it involve, but what does it involve? Why is it not hyperbolic to say that something like Bitcoin is Ikigai?
First off, you explained it perfectly, Frank. I think for me, I've been breathing Bitcoin for the last couple of years.
Mm.
I wake up thinking about Bitcoin. I sleep thinking about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I talk to everyone around me about Bitcoin. I see Bitcoin as the only reason, I mean, the only hope for humanity, for Lebanese. I think it's Bitcoin, because if you study and you realize and to the reality that it's all down to the money problems and what is money, you realize and you understand Bitcoin, at least I feel like Bitcoin is the solution. And I want to educate people about Bitcoin. I want to build about it in Bitcoin. I want to invest in Bitcoin. I want to help others do the same as well. So the Ikigai is like what I love. This is my passion, really.
Yeah.
And this is what the world needs. This is my vocation, I feel. And this is something I like to be paid in it. This is something, a passion. I have fun this talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
over a drink in Ghana.
Yeah.
Or like to work as a profession. You have no experts in Bitcoin. We all complement each other. But in the area I do, I think I'm good at it. So this is why I think it's my Ikigai. Of course, we need to continuously learn and improve. And
yeah.
There's a lot that I don't know. And it's like it's the center of all these areas. If you the coinciding, you have like the four main pillars and the coinciding circles inside of them. The center is the Ikigai. It's like this is the common denominator across all these topics.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is why it's my Ikigai. I think Jack Dorsey has put it. I don't know. I think he did, but what he had when he left Twitter moved to Block, and then moved and said that he wants to live like Bitcoin is his reason, or like he, whatever he wants to,
Yeah,
his purpose in
his
life
purpose. Yeah.
is Bitcoin. This is also a clear definition of what Bitcoin or Ikigai is.
Yeah, I agree. It hit me so hard, and I had to actually hear people say it back to me. But I was probably one of the few people in New York City at one point. I was doing my MBA and my MSW, so Master's in Business Administration and my Master's in Social Work at the same time, because I had sort of an equal passion for both. And then when I found something like Bitcoin, where you sort of have to do the work on the community level, educate people, and I was teaching while I did all this, it was like, oh, okay, I found. And I didn't know it existed. And what was funny was, I would sit in the MBA classes and just be bored to tears. I was just taking them because they were free. I was teaching at that university, and I don't like traditional finance. It's not that I hate it. It doesn't excite me. There's nothing about it that really motivates me the way that that Bitcoin does, because of the nature of Bitcoin. And with the social work side of things, a lot of it it's a lot of antiquated ways of thinking. It's like, if you're not a hardcore Marxist and you don't believe in like the state should be in control of everything and create equality, then you're just like on the outs. You can't be a part of the conversation. And I'm like, well, I don't believe in that. I believe in human action and the human spirit, and the ability for people to try to get themselves out of a situation they're in. And it's only been in the Bitcoin community that I've found some level of peace, to be honest, because I think there's a sort of similar disdain for TradFi. There's a sort of love for humanity amongst many of the people here, and it has led me to, to finding people like you. And it's one of the few places where I don't feel like a crazy person. So very glad that that we got to talk and that we can continue this relationship. Before we wrap this up, please let people know where they can find you online and anything else you're involved with.
Thanks, Frank. First off, just before you mentioned about like teaching legislators in the US about Bitcoin, and you're like thinking about it. Just do it, man. Every voice counts, really. And yeah, where people can find me on Noster. I don't have the pub key memorized, but you can find me on it's Suli on Noster at Suli, and Twitter at Suli SOLY underscore Kobayashi. And that's, yeah, I mean, it's the same all over the networks, the same handle. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And I'm looking what's happening last is I'm speaking at the Dubai Bitcoin conference, the first Bitcoin only conference next month, so I'm excited to that. And yeah, I feel awful. I missed the South Africa Bitcoin conference happening this month, but yeah, there's a lot of traveling, so yeah, looking forward to seeing you in the next one.
Well, that's it, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure to follow Suli online. And also check out, I didn't mention it in this conversation, but check out his link tree. I think maybe type in his name, Suli Kobayashi. He's got amazing resources there, educational resources that you can dive into for free. So please check that out. And we'll leave it there. Suli, we will talk soon. Thank you for taking the time to do this. And talk soon, everybody. Take it easy.